Fish, Deep Throat, Rashid, The Psycho Man, Mehdi, Malek, Golam, Sayed, and Charlie Brown. All other names are real. Secondly, in recalling conversations that took place 3 or 4 years ago, people rarely remember the exact words used. Furthermore, real-life conversation, with its gestures and interruptions and unfinished sentences, often makes no sense when it is written down. So the dialogue in this book is both reconstructed and edited. However, every reconstructed conversation has been shown to at least one of the participants for correction or approval. With those two qualifications, I believe every word of what follows is true. This is not a fictionalization or a non-fiction novel. I have not invented anything. What you are about to read is what really happened.
I bear you on eagle's wings and brought you unto myself. Exodus chapter 19, verse 4.
On Wings of Eagles, chapter 1. It all started on December 5th, 1978. Jay Coburn, director of personnel for EDS Corporation, Iran, sat in his office in uptown Tehran with a lot on his mind. The office was in a three-story concrete building known as Bucharest, because it was in an alley off Bucharest Street. Coburn was on the second floor, in a room large by American standards. It had a parquet floor, a smart wood executive desk, and a picture of the Shah on the wall. He sat with his back to the window. Through the glass door, he could see into the open-plan office where his staff sat at typewriters and telephones. The glass door had curtains, but Coburn never closed them. It was cold. It was always cold. Thousands of Iranians were on strike. The city's power supply was intermittent, and the heating was off for several hours most days. Coburn was a tall, broad-shouldered man, 5 feet 11 inches and 200 pounds. His red-brown hair was cut businessman short and carefully combed with a part. Although he was only 32, he looked nearer to 40. On closer examination, his youth showed in his attractive open face and ready smile. But he had an air of early maturity, the look of a man who grew up too fast. All his life he had shouldered responsibility, as a boy working in his father's flower shop, at the age of 20 as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam, as a young husband and father, and now as personnel director, holding in his hands the safety of 131 American employees and their 220 dependents in a city where mob violence ruled the streets. Today, like every day, he was making phone calls around Tehran, trying to find out where the fighting was, where it would break out next, and what the prospects were for the next few days. He called the U.S. Embassy at least once a day. The embassy had an information room that was manned 24 hours a day. Americans would call in from different areas of the city to report demonstrations and riots, and the embassy would spread the news that this district or that was to be avoided. But for advance information and advice, Coburn found the embassy close to useless. At weekly briefings, which he attended faithfully, he would always be told that Americans should stay indoors as much as possible and keep away from crowds at all costs, but that the Shah was in control and evacuation was not recommended at this time. Coburn understood their problem. If the U.S. Embassy said the Shah was tottering, the Shah would surely fall. But they were so cautious, they hardly gave out any information at all. Disenchanted with the embassy, the American business community in Tehran had set up its own information network. The biggest U.S. corporation in town was Bell Helicopter, whose Iran operation was run by a retired Major General, Robert N. McKinnon. McKinnon had a first-class intelligence service, and he shared everything. Coburn also knew a couple of intelligence officers in the U.S. military, and he called them. Today, the city was relatively quiet. There were no major demonstrations. The last outbreak of serious trouble had been 3 days earlier, on December 2nd, the first day of the general strike, when 700 people had been reported killed in street fighting. According to Coburn's sources, the lull could be expected to continue until December 10th, the Muslim holy day of Ashura. Coburn was worried about Ashura. The Muslim winter holiday was not a bit like Christmas. A day of fasting and mourning for the death of the Prophet's grandson, Hussein. His keynote was remorse. There would be massive street processions, during which the more devout believers would flog themselves. In that atmosphere, hysteria and violence could erupt fast. This year, Coburn feared the violence might be directed against Americans. A series of nasty incidents had convinced him that anti-American feeling was growing rapidly. A card had been pushed through his door saying, "If you value your life and possessions, get out of Iran." Friends of his had received similar postcards. Spray can artists had painted "Americans live here" on the wall of his house. The bus that took his children to the Tehran American School had been rocked by a crowd of demonstrators. Other EDS employees had been yelled at in the streets and had had their cars damaged. One scary afternoon, Iranians at the Ministry of Health and Social Welfare, EDS's biggest customer, had gone on the rampage, smashing windows and burning pictures of the Shah, while EDS executives in the building barricaded themselves inside an office until the mob went away. In some ways, the most sinister development was the change in the attitude of Coburn's landlord. Like most Americans in Tehran, Coburn rented half of a two-family home. He and his wife and